ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
It's Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing the world of classic cinema. As always, I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. And after a prolonged and unexpected hiatus, we jump into Ticklish Business Christmas. Haven't really thought of anything catchier than that, as I'm joined by guest Howard Kasner to talk about the 70th anniversary of Miracle on 34th Street.
She's a little confused, and I thought maybe you could help to straighten her out.
I'll be glad to.
Would you please tell her that you're not really Santa Claus? That there actually is no such person?
Well, I'm sorry to disagree with you, Mrs. Walker, but not only is there such a person, but here I am to prove it.
No. You misunderstand. I want you to tell her the truth. What's your name?
Kris Kringle.
I'll bet you're in the first grade.
Second.
I mean your real name.
That is my real name.
Second grade?
It's a progressive school.
In the late 1940s, screenwriter Valentin Davies found himself sitting in line at a department store at Christmas time, bemoaning the growing commercialism of the holiday. He took that frustration to director and screenwriter George Seton, who cobbled together a script entitled The Big Heart. The story, as it would be laid out in the finished product, follows a disillusioned little girl and her mother who learned about faith through a meeting with Santa Claus. The first person to read the script was actor John Payne. Upset by the lackluster roles he'd received previously, he bought the rights to the story and took the film to 20th Century Fox, who decided to distribute it. As for Davies, he would turn the story into a novella released around the time of the film, but didn't get nearly as much credit for the creation of the film as Seton ultimately would. It was originally feared that the script's constant references to Macy's and Gimbel's, two prominent stores at the time, would have to be excised unless they gave their approval, which would pretty much result in the entire movie being changed. The studio alerted the stores to the film, but refused to let them see anything until the movie was complete. It was a huge gamble, but in the end, both Macy's and Gimbel's loved the film's message, and I'm sure they loved how it made them look like kind, caring companies that eschewed corporate greed and allowed their names to be utilized. Macy's has definitely profited off of the success of Miracle on 34th Street. If you've seen any of their ads playing this year, they usually reference the film.
For the past 50 years or so, I've been getting more and more worried about Christmas. Seems we're all so busy trying to beat the other fellow in making things go faster and look shinier and cost less that Christmas and I are sort of getting lost in the shuffle.
Oh, I don't think so. Christmas is still Christmas.
Oh, Christmas isn't just a day. It's a frame of mind. And that's what's been changing. That's why I'm glad I'm here. Maybe I can do something about it.
Production on the film was smooth for the most part, outside of filming during a New York winter so cold that the cameras literally froze. Filmed throughout November of 1946, Seton and crew took to filming the actual Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade that year. Because the parade wouldn't stop for the production, the crew had to plan everything with military precision, placing camera crews at specific spots along the parade route. Though I'm sure Edmund Gwenn's performance as Santa, actually seen in the film as it was filmed, went off without a hitch. It certainly made the parade an American institution after the movie's release. The cast consisted of several prominent stars of the Fox lot. Irish star Maureen O'Hara was initially furious being brought onto the picture at all, after just arriving in her native country the month before filming started after a 7-year absence that was necessitated by the outbreak of World War II. When Fox commanded she return to start production on Miracle on 34th Street, she said, quote, "I was madder than a wet hen the whole flight back." But after reading the script, O'Hara had a change of heart, and later considered Miracle on 34th Street her favorite movie that she'd ever worked on. The busiest star, though, was young Natalie Wood, playing the skeptical Susan. Though this was only her third credited role, she filmed this concurrently with the Jean Tierney drama The Ghost of Mrs. Muir. Everyone got along, particularly with Santa himself, British character actor Edmund Gwenn. Wood said she believed that Gwenn truly was Santa until she became a teenager. He enjoyed his time working on the film, and Gwenn would re-team with Santa the next year on the wartime romantic drama Apartment for Peggy.
Oh, you were right, Mommy. Mommy told me if things don't turn out just the way you want them to the first time, you still got to believe. And I kept believing, and you were right, Mommy. Mr. Kringle is Santa Claus.
Where are you going?
To see if there's a swing!
It might surprise you to know that Miracle on 34th Street wasn't released anywhere near Christmas time. The finished product was released on May 2, 1947, under the belief from studio head Daryl Zanuck that audiences tended to see more movies in warmer weather. Guess we have Zanuck to blame for the summer movie season. With a budget of just under $630,000, the movie eventually grossed just over $2 million at the US box office alone, which was really rare at the time. Reviews were mostly positive, but the Catholic Legion of Decency gave the movie a B grade because Maureen O'Hara's Doris was a divorcee. Miracle on 34th Street went on to win 3 Academy Awards in 1948, Best Writing for Valentin Davies' original story, Best Adapted Screenplay, and Best Supporting Actor for Edmund Gwenn, whose Oscar speech was, quote, "Now I know there's a Santa Claus." While it was nominated for Best Picture that year, it would lose to the Gregory Peck drama Gentleman's Agreement.
They say that seeing is believing. But the truth is, the world is held together by things you can't see.
There really has to be something you want for Christmas.
A house, a brother, and a dad. That's all I ever want.
And after all this time, Miracle on 34th Street remains a Christmas staple. In 1985, it was the first film to receive the dreaded colorization treatment, and if you watch AMC this Christmas, you'll probably end up seeing this horrifically colorized. It's been remade several times, starting in 1955, when the 20th Century Fox Hour presented an hour-long adaptation of the story that starred Teresa Wright and Thomas Mitchell. It was later remade in 1959 with Ed Wynn as Kris Kringle. Another television version aired in 1973 that starred Jane Alexander, David Hartman, and Roddy McDowall, with Sebastian Cabot playing the Edmund Gwenn part. Broadway even took a stab at the film in 1963 with the musical Here's Love starring Janis Paige. If you're under 30, then you've probably seen the big-budget remake from 1994 that starred Mara Wilson in the Natalie Wood part. Written by John Hughes, that studio couldn't convince Macy's to give their name over a second time. Macy's infamously stated, quote, "We feel the original stands on its own and could not be improved upon." They probably knew something we didn't. That's not to say someone didn't believe lightning could strike twice. Till his dying day, actor John Payne, who played Fred Gailey in the 1947 film, wanted to make a sequel. He eventually wrote a script with plans to present it to Maureen O'Hara for consideration. Unfortunately, Payne died in 1989, with his script disappearing into the ether. After the break, Howard Kasner and I discuss and compare two versions of Miracle on 34th Street, the 1947 original and the 1994 remake.
Your Honor, every one of these letters is addressed to Santa Claus. The post office has delivered them. Therefore, the Post Office Department, a branch of the federal government, recognizes this man, Kris Kringle, to be the one and only Santa Claus.
Since the United States government declares this man to be Santa Claus, this court will not dispute it. Case dismissed.
Hello, listeners. Our first of a couple of Christmas episodes. We went from having two Christmas episodes to, I think, having at least three. So expect this as your Christmas gift for the year. Today, I am talking with the fantastic Howard Kasner. Howard, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
I am great. I'm very excited that we get to talk about two very different yet similar movies. Howard, in case people don't know who you are, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
I do have a blog called Rantings and Ravings. I'm an aspiring screenwriter, but I make a living doing coverage and reading screenplays for competitions and a production company. My blog is a combination of essays to help screenwriters, as well as I do review movies as well. I've been big movie nut since high school, and maybe over-exaggerated because I live in Corpus Christi, Texas, and we didn't get a wide variety of movies. I really upped my game in 2001 when I moved to Los Angeles and started writing screenplays.
And you are a big classic film fan. I know that as well, because we have been on a couple podcasts and talked about classic cinema. So it's always great to have somebody who I know talks about classic film, but also knows contemporary stuff as well. But of course, today we are diving into Christmas. We are looking at the 60th anniversary of the 1947 film Miracle on 34th Street. I was going to say The Miracle of Morgan's Creek, but we already did that episode. Different miracle taking place there. Miracle on 34th Street is, I don't know if it's my favorite Christmas movie. It's definitely one of my favorite Christmas movies, mostly because I love Natalie Wood. And I think she's just so cute and delightful as this skeptic. What is your background with this movie? I'm assuming this isn't the first time you'd seen the 47 version.
No, I saw it sometime on TV. I couldn't even remember when. It could be back as far as the 70s or the 80s, even earlier, maybe when I was in high school. So yes, I've only seen this before. I did watch it again, as for the other one, the remake. It was the first time I had some little snippets of the made-for-TV movie, but I didn't watch the whole thing.
There are various incarnations of this movie. Most people know the 47 version. A lot of people my age know the 94 version, which we're going to touch on in a little bit. And then there's the 1959 TV movie, which is very hard to find. I know a couple people had asked if I had seen that or if I knew where I could get my hands on it, and I had to tell them, you know, no.
It may not be possible. That was the time when they were doing live broadcasting for these things.
This has been a movie that's been told a couple of times. Hollywood really liked doing made-for-TV versions of these 40s Christmas films.
Almost any successful movie, they would adapt it often for Lux Radio or something
that's
else.
That's right. They did adapt and this.
And then there was the TV version, I think, which was before the 1995 version, with Sebastian Cabot as Santa Claus.
The movie is still very appealing. The 47 version, at least. We'll talk about what the 94 movie does right and mostly does questionably. I've watched this several times now, and it's really intriguing to watch this from 60 years later and knowing that it was a post-World War II movie. I think that's what a lot of people forget, is that you watch this movie now, and I know Macy's uses this as their marketing gimmick come Christmas time. You'll probably see clips played during the holidays about this movie. This came out 2 years after World War II had ended. It's really an intriguing look at how people were being marketed to post-World War II, because the interest rates had been lowered significantly in the wake of the war to get the economy back up, and that only ended up creating long-term high inflation and unemployment. But this movie is telling everybody, you know, as long as you make the kids happy, Santa Claus is a wonderful man, and he's wonderfully played by Edmund Gwenn, but he's also the one person telling everybody, go buy stuff. Go to whatever store you want, as long as it makes your kids happy. How do you feel about that?
Well, I do think it is interesting that the reason why Santa has come back is because he feels like Christmas has become so commercialized that what he defines as non-commercialization is giving kids the toy they want, which is actually the definition of commercialization. And also, it's basically an hour and 45-minute commercial for Macy's. It is kind of funny that it has this theme that really doesn't quite support. But it's such an enjoyable film and a well-made film that you can kind of forget that and gloss over that.
I noticed it this time around. I hadn't noticed it before, is that the movies really has this story of commercialism and cooperation. Macy's yes. and Gimbel's come together, even right. though they know it's a marketing gimmick, they're still, I'll raise you this amount of money. They work together. And it's almost like the movie is saying, stores, governments, what have you, we're all in it for the almighty dollar. But yeah. there's also this ability that we are the only ones that can, that have the money and the financial stability to do good deeds. It's a very right. confusing message.
Yes, I think it is. It says it's against commercialization, but almost everything about it is pro-commercialization. So I guess in a way, I think it's very clever that they managed to make you sort of forget that and go for the heart of the story, which is believing in Santa Claus and believing that we can make each other happy.
A lot of that has to do with Edmund Gwenn, who Natalie Wood, as a child, truly believed was Santa Claus. And I believe it, too, because I think he's really well done in a way. And I guess we'll start kind of blending in the 94 version, too. Edmund Gwenn is better in a way that Richard Attenborough, even though Richard Attenborough is a good actor, the Attenborough character always comes off as a bit too dark for a Christmas movie.
The whole movie comes off as a bit too dark.
I was going to say, the whole movie is bizarrely bleak.
Yes. I mean, the remake, it takes themselves so seriously. And I'm going, how can you take a movie about whether there's Santa Claus or not seriously? I mean, it's not that serious a topic. And if you take it really seriously. And so Richard Attenborough is much more serious than Edmund Gwenn. But Edmund Gwenn, it's one of these things with the studio system. They had all these actors on the lot that were paid by the week. If they didn't work, then they're just taking money without working. So they had to make them work. And you have this incredible stable of supporting actors, of character actors, just a huge number that can fit in anywhere. And here we have probably Edmund Gwenn in the greatest of his roles. with that twinkle in his eye. I mean, he just really is so charismatic, very Santa Claus-like.
Well, he's got this playfulness to him. One minute he can be joking with John Payne's character about whether he sleeps with his whiskers under the covers or not.
Yeah.
Most of his point is to make Susan, the Natalie Wood character, a child, because she's become very self-serious. She goes to a progressive school where she doesn't believe in Santa Claus. And a lot of his playfulness comes from wanting her to be able to appreciate her childhood. Which I'm sure ties into post-World War II sentiments that now that we're out of wartime, children can afford to play now. Whereas the Attenborough is almost kind of sprite-like. He's got this weird little malevolent streak to him.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about some of the plot changes that the remake makes that are very bizarre, but it all culminates with him hitting a person with his cane and it comes off as a bit more menacing. They bring up constantly his temper. You know, Richard Attenborough's character always wants to jump up and say something, and he has to be, like, talked off the ledge. Whereas Edmund Gwenn is just very dignified, and he bears this with this stoicism. Doesn't feel the need to confront. It's not confrontational.
Well, one thing in the remake that they do is, just by getting dark, James Remar's character accuses Santa Claus of being a pedophile.
The guy that James Remar and Jane Leaves' character pays to essentially provoke him.
And family film, he's accusing Santa Claus of being a pedophile, and I'm sort of going, I think you're taking this all just a little too seriously. Santa Claus and the original Edmund Gwenn, they were just sort of accusing him of being crazy.
We would see as the 1950s would start this dichotomy between law and order versus science. So I always chart this as the psychiatrist character, who is the villain in the 47 version, is really just like, there's no Santa Claus. He must be crazy. That's about as dark as the villainy gets. In the remake, which is almost 2 hours and has no reason to be at all, the international cooperation between stores is gone in the remake. You have the generic Kohl's versus the big box store called Shoppers Express. And James Remar and Jane Leaves' characters are these corporate spies that are trying to get Richard Attenborough Santa to come onto their side. And when they can't do that, it's this weird conspiracy plot line that takes effect. Commercialism for the wrong reasons. There's not that dichotomy of faith, which the 47 version is all about faith. And it's not a religious faith. It's just like the belief in the goodness of people. You don't have that in the 90s remake.
In the remake, you have a lot of faith. It's not about belief in God. It's just not even about belief in Santa Claus. The remake is about believing in God. And that's the 47 version was not about that at all.
Yeah.
I thought there was a strange reach that made. I thought we were talking about whether this guy was Santa Claus. I didn't think we were going to be debating whether God actually exists.
Yeah, you know? I was thinking, so is Santa Claus God? I'm not understanding what your conceit here is. When you bring up the studio system, you're culling from a stable that you have handy, and what a stable of performers is in this movie.
Yes. Over and over and over again.
John Payne actually had bought the rights to this movie. He was sick of the performances that he was given, so he wanted to star as a leading man in this movie, and he does. He plays Mr. Gailey, the guy that just happens to live in their building and takes Natalie Wood, Susan, under his wing as a companion and is the love interest for Maureen O'Hara's Doris character.
He's probably the weakest, when it comes to acting, he's probably the weakest cast. And then the remake, who do they get? Dylan McDermott, 1990s version of John Payne.
Mm-hmm. I can tell you that the only reason I've seen the 94 remake is because I love Dylan McDermott. He's definitely in that weird, if you're a kid like me who grew up in the 90s, he's in that weird John Stamos, Uncle Jesse mode, where he's non-threatening, but he's good looking, so you're really confused about how you're supposed to feel about him. And in the movie,
he's pretty bland. They're both pretty bland.
Yes, but they do attempt to integrate him, I think, into the narrative. He's some type of a lawyer that works with Kohl's in some way. There's an allusion to some type of relationship with Elizabeth Perkins' version of the Maureen O'Hara character
I never got the idea that he worked for Kohl's. In fact, in order to defend Santa Claus, he quits the law firm he works for.
That's right.
There would be no need for him to with an offer.
He has even less of a reason to exist than the Mr. Gailey character does.
Yeah.
Both of the characters are fine. They really only come alive in the third act, which is why I think the third act here in the 47 version works better, because you get just enough John Payne that you're like, okay, he did his job well. The 94 version, the third act is so long. You seem to get a lot of Dylan McDermott. That brings me to my question. Who is the star of the 94 version to you? Because the 47 version, Maureen O'Hara and John Payne, and I think Edmund Gwenn are billed first. Natalie Wood is billed fifth. In the 94 remake, Elizabeth Perkins, Dylan McDermott, and Richard Attenborough billed first, but Mara Wilson gets the "and," which means she made more money.
It was her first film, wasn't it?
I think it might have been her second. Mrs. Doubtfire was before this.
It was. And that's why she gets the "and" at the end, too. As close as you get to equal billing if you're not the star.
So who would you say is the star of each of these movies? Because I would say in the 47 version, Natalie Wood is definitely on its screen just as much as the other adults. But in the 94 version, I can't tell you who's the star because the movie is so choppy.
It is. And Mara Wilson is no Natalie Wood.
She is not. Natalie Wood was billed fifth in this movie. She was filming this concurrently with The Ghost of Mrs. Muir. She's a lot of fun. Can see why she would become a bigger star as she got older, because she's inquisitive. She's not quite an adult in a child's body, but she's getting there. I love her side eye when she's giving Edmund Gwenn those like looks like, I don't think you're really Santa Claus. Whereas Mara Wilson is definitely a little adult shrunk down to child size. There's nothing really playful about her performance.
Kind of annoying.
I was going to say she's very cutesy.
And that's it. She's cutesy, but she doesn't drive the story like Natalie Wood. It's all about making Natalie Wood. It's all about making that kid believe in Santa Claus. And of course, John Payne hopes then to worm his way into Maureen O'Hara's good graces because he wants to court her. The remake is so choppy and nothing seems to be that together or what everybody wants. One interesting thing though about the original is that the romance between Maureen O'Hara and John Payne basically happens off screen. You never see the moment when they fall in love. You see the before and then afterwards when he comes in and they kiss and they're going, when did that happen? That scene must be on the drawing room floor. In the remake, you actually do believe it, but I'm going, any guy who asks a woman to marry him after one date, of course he's going to say no. Kiss and they've known each other for a very long time, and he's trying to do this for a very long time, but it's not shown, and it's just really creepy.
So Natalie Wood and Mara Wilson, cultivated this performance as being the cynic as a child. So when she walks up to the judge in the third act of this movie to deliver a Christmas card, it just seems like, okay, you're an entitled little girl. You don't expect Natalie Wood to do that because that character would not be confident enough because she's still a child. But then you bring up the romance. And the romance element of the 94 version, Elizabeth Perkins to me I think is the weakest link in the remake because she really has no purpose other than being the cynical woman. If you watch the 47 version, Natalie Wood's belief in what she can see and reality is fostered by her mother, but it's not created by her mother. It's enhanced by her school, getting the illusion that it's enhanced by the world, and growing up in the post-war atmosphere. In the 94 version, they say, nope, her mother is so bitter that her husband left her, that she has convinced her daughter that there is no good in the world. And Dylan McDermott is the only person who can instill this childlike belief back in her daughter. Leaves the Doris figure in the 94 version very callous, very cold. The marriage proposal is so tone deaf, but at the same time, they really try hard to make you hate her character. I think it's just unnecessary. And it all culminates with my biggest pet peeve about the 94 remake, which is Susan's Christmas wish. In the 47 version, Susan just wants stability. She wants a house. Right. And that's all she wants. In the 94 version, because it's the 90s and we have to go big, Susan doesn't just want the house. So she wants that house. But she also wants a dad and a little brother. Yeah. And I'm sitting there thinking, okay, who's going to tell her the problems with at least one of those things?
Well, and Richard Attenborough did. said, you know how long it takes to get a little brother? It's about 9 months. 8 months if you're a preemie, 10 months if you're late.
I think Richard Attenborough also forgets to tell her, like, the central conceit. Your mom needs to want that. That's not her wish. That's your wish. And I think we need to get consent here in some way, shape, or form. And that's always my big problem. The 94 version ends with the reveal, equally tone-deaf reveal. Hi, Susan. This guy's going to be living with us now. We got married. I hope you're okay with it. And we totally slept together because we're both wearing bathrobes.
Yeah.
I'm just sitting there thinking, this is a children's movie, guys. We're going to have to explain to people leaving the theater how that ending scene plays out. It's the biggest question mark I have. There's no reason to change what she wants. I don't understand why we did.
To be honest, if we wanted an updated version, what you would do is they'd already be living together, just not getting married.
Mm-hmm.
They kept the 30s morality instead of updating it to a 90s morality, which actually helped if they had updated the morality.
There's a couple of scenes they outright recreate. I don't think all of them work, but the one that I think works the best is there's a scene in the 47 version where a little Dutch girl comes to see Santa Claus.
Very American accent.
The mother says, we just adopted her, which again goes back to that post-war atmosphere.
Well, yeah, because you know what happened to her parents, 47.
So this girl's obviously had a really hard life. He speaks Dutch with her. They sing Jingle Bells. It's very sweet. And I read on IMDb, the translation of their discussion is she doesn't need anything for Christmas because she's already got a mother. It's very sweet. But if you don't know the background, you're not really going to understand it. The 94 version does the same scene, only the little girl is deaf. And he signs with her. I think that's a very, very cute update because I'm a big person who's about, you know, disability in cinema. But I've always wondered, how does somebody who deaf or blind, how do you deal with going to see Santa Claus, especially if the Santa Claus has no idea what to do? I thought that was a really sweet update. What did you think about that?
I thought it was fine. It just seems to me that they just updated it, that there's nothing behind it. I mean, in the original, When you find out that she's Dutch, you know instantly that her parents died in Europe. They don't say whether she's Jewish or not. And that's why she's deaf, and it's sweet that he talks to her as she's deaf. It doesn't really bring that much to the story. It's just...
If you've seen the original, you know that it's there.
Like if she had been Vietnamese or if she had been Chinese.
There's so many white people in this movie. For an updated movie, there is, I noticed it this time around. So they're in New York, but I am not seeing any people of color. That's very interesting.
Well, now that you mentioned it, I was going to bring up something that I think is interesting, and that is the use of black characters in the 47 version. The maid Cleo is played by Teresa Harris. As I've been watching movies of the year, every once in a while I would notice this character, a black actress playing a maid, but she wasn't a light, a sassy mammy. She was always a very dignified. And I didn't know who she was. I would just see her every once in a while. And finally, I looked her up. And she has an IMDb that is a mile long. Huge number of films, most of the time uncredited. But she always played the very dignified maid. And you can see her in Alias McBeal and Out of the Past, I Walk with a Zombie, Cat People. Perhaps the most interesting role she ever played was in that notorious pre-code baby face with Barbara Stanwyck, where she plays Barbara Stanwyck's best friend, and they treat each other as equals. Also in this, and I don't know whether it's done purposely or what, at the post office scene, there is a black extra sorting mail. I don't know if they did that on purpose or if they just used the people who are already there sorting the mail instead of hiring extras. Black actors didn't get all that much. I tend to notice whenever there are black extras or something like that. And I think Teresa Harris is a wonderful actress that should be better known, talked about a lot more.
It's amazing and it's sad to see some of these stars have endless amounts of credits and just are unrecognized. One of the scenes I think that is translated and it doesn't work as well, maybe because it doesn't have the character actress that's in it, is there is a scene in the 47 version where the little boy wants a fire engine that squirts real water out in the backyard. Exactly. And it's his mother is Thelma Ritter.
Who also gets no credit. Most of the people in the movie didn't get any credit. That's sort of the way it was at the end. Just before her Big Breakthrough and All About Eve.
So she shows up and she says they don't have it. And that's where Santa gives the spiel about, oh, go to this other store. It's cheaper and it makes the kids happy. They do that same scene. Thelma Ritter is in that moment. And then she goes up to the guy and says, made a coal shopper out of me because you're putting the children before the commercialism, even though you're putting the children alongside the commercialism. But right. That's neither here nor there. In the remake, it's the same moment. Allison Janney is actually in the scene.
An incredibly young Allison Janney.
Yes.
I was watching that and I was like, is that Allison Janney?
She's in it talking about a barf gun. That's the point that ruins it for me, is I was like, why does it have to be about barf? Why? Can't it just be a toy gun of some kind? The 90s really embraced juvenilism. It doesn't work. It's so over the top.
It is. I mean, the one thing in the original, it just wasn't Thelma Ritter that convinced them to do this. They were getting all sorts of feedback from their shoppers. I thought it was odd in the remake that you take one comment by one shopper and you arrange a whole marketing team behind it. But in 47, they just said, we've had all these mothers come up to us. The other thing I thought was, if I remember right, and correct me if I'm wrong, the gun cost $70 at Kohl's and $39.99 at the Express. And I'm going, I'm sorry, $39.99 is way too much. $70 for a toy?
She emphasizes they throw in the batteries or the barf or something. They throw something in too.
Well, $40 is a lot more manageable, isn't it? And I got, well, if you can't afford $70, my guess is you probably don't want to pay $40 either. That's still a little steep.
Yeah, I was just wishing that Santa Claus would look at this kid and be all, don't you want anything else? There has to be a better toy out there. This was one of two Christmas movies nominated in 47 for Best Picture.
Right.
The other was The Bishop's Wife, which also received a 90s remake. In total, this is only one of three Christmas films, so this, The Bishop's Wife, and It's a Wonderful Life, that was nominated for Best Picture.
If you have a very strict definition, because The Thin Man was nominated for Best Picture.
I consider The Thin Man a Christmas movie.
It wasn't especially a Christmas movie like these are.
You can't discount how 2 years after World War II, and we're still just trying to really come up with these movies that instill faith in some form, whether it's The Bishop's Wife, which is a religious faith, or this movie, Believing in Your Fellow Man, mostly because I don't think we make Christmas movies like this anymore, that we haven't gotten another one.
We certainly make Christmas movies. I mean, every year, somebody is doing a Christmas movie. We don't have very many, I can't say good ones, because a lot of them are very successful. The audience really, really likes them. But none of them seem to have as much heart as the ones. I mean, It's a Wonderful Life has a very important theme to it. And it's very dark. Mm-hmm. It's very, very dark, but it's a lot of heart for the last 20, 30 years. They haven't quite figured out how to do it. The closest that they've ever come to is A Christmas Story, which is a wonderful, wonderful movie. But I don't think it was as successful, except afterwards.
We don't get the Christmas movies, I think, because so many of them now are, I hate to use the term, but the faith-based genre, preaching to the converted, based on Christian or Catholicism. The one thing that I love about these types of Christmas movies is that they're very secular, but you can still imbue, if you want to take a faith-based message to your own faith or not, right. There's options.
Not secular, but they're non-denominational.
Yes, yes. That's the term I was going for there. But the one thing I wanted to point out, which we're speaking about other Christmas movies, the 94 remake doesn't seem to know what Christmas movie it wants to be. The music box that Kris Kringle plays for Susan in the 94 remake, is playing the Christmas song from Meet Me in St. Louis, which is a 1944 movie that wasn't from Fox. It's a different studio. Dylan McDermott's character's last name is Bedford, which makes me think of Bedford Falls, which makes me think of It's a Wonderful Life.
Yes, I didn't think that because the name is Brian Bedford, and all I think about is the English actor. The use of the music, though, I'm not sure is that big a deal, because by that time, the studio that made Yes, on 34th Street. Quite possibly owned the right.
I think the song has become, in the common parlance, so many people have remade it. I know it's from Meet Me in St. Louis, but I doubt most right. people in 94, they would just know it from like Bing Crosby singing it or something. You know, it doesn't right. have that connotation. I find it weird that this movie cherry picks from every other Christmas movie except the one that it's making.
The original had a unified vision. It's not perfect, but it's a lot of fun. And it's extremely well made, which is sort of the epitome of studios to do with their resources, even for a rather low-key movie like this. I don't even know why he made the movie. I think the big person behind it was John Hughes. And I have no idea why he wanted to remake this movie.
John Hughes was of Mr. Christmas in the 90s, between this and the Home Alone movies. He had done the previous two Home Alones.
Better than this.
Well, they're definitely shorter. I cannot stress, the remake has no business being 2 hours. The original is 96 minutes, and you get the story. Let's talk about the ending, how Kris Kringle ends in both iterations.
Before we quite get to that, when it comes to the trial, it should probably be noted that in both cases, the trial makes no sense.
Yes. There's numerous ways that the judge could have gotten him off.
What's at stake is not whether he is Santa Claus or not. That's totally irrelevant. That has nothing to do with anything. Even if he only thought he was Santa Claus, you can't put him away for that. The trial should have been about whether he was violent or not.
Yes.
Because if he's violent or not, then you can put him away. But once the prosecuting attorney asks him if you're Santa, and he says yes, he says, I rest, then the judge should say, well, if that's the only evidence you're going to give, I'm going to dismiss all charges because you can't put him away.
There's no reason to waste the taxpayers' money in either version.
Yeah. The original done much better in many ways. So this is William Frawley in the original.
Yes, I was going to say, William Frawley, is before he was Fred Mertz, he shows up in this movie.
And the pressure he puts on by saying, you know, you're up for re-election. In the remake, it's a vaguely threat from the owner of the Shoppers Express. Mm-hmm. And it's very vague, and it's dropped as soon as it's made. There's no threat here. What does the judge care what happens? Because there's nothing at stake. But in the original, there is something at stake. He's worried if he doesn't do exactly the right thing, he may not get reelected.
I think it's important to point out the 90s saw a lot of big corporate mergers happen. So you're watching this and you're thinking, oh, so it's just reminding you, like, big corporations, they can control our trial system, they can put Santa Claus away. It's a bit better in the 47 version because it's just the concept of, do you really want to be the guy that is responsible for putting Santa in jail? It's just the smarter version.
And then I think that's where the original is brilliant. They found a brilliant solution when Jack Albertson is sorting that mail. And they said, well, we'll just send all this mail to the courthouse. And I thought that was a brilliant way to resolve the issue. I don't know who came up with that. It must have been Valentin Davies who came up with the story. But what an incredibly clever way to get everybody out of the pressure cooker they're in.
By making Kris Kringle free through the use of the mail, goes back to that post-World War II spirit of, if we all do this, all of us as Americans or worldwide, we can save Santa Claus. It gives this community unity. Whereas in the remake, it's Mara Wilson presenting a Christmas card to the judge that Brian has told her to do. So I don't know how legal that is. That just is the dollar bill with In God We Trust. And his argument is that if we can put that we believe in God on our money, then we should be able to believe that Kris Kringle is the embodiment of Santa Claus. A, it totally removes the community element, and much like any 90s show where one family, if you watch Full House, why were the Tanners at the center of everything? Apparently, the only people that matter are Mara Wilson's character and Dylan McDermott. They're the only two people that come up with this plan and execute it to get Kris out of the loony bin. And it turns into this whole, well, we put God on our money, so ipso facto, we believe in God and we believe in this guy. It's a stretch.
It certainly reduces God. We can say that God exists. We have the legal right to say that Santa Claus exists. I'm going, you're really putting God on the same level as Santa Claus?
Exactly. And I don't think anybody's taking away your right to believe in Santa Claus. It only shows how shaky the plot is to begin with, which is that he shouldn't be on trial for being Santa Claus. He should be on trial for whether he's a threat to himself or others.
Yeah. And I just never bought it. I didn't think Robert Klosky would read the dollar bill and he would come up with this. The Bill McDermott's character would actually think that he would get it from that. And then you have that very long monologue that Klosky delivers.
Pull from a better classic film, which I still have problems with. If anybody remembers, I think it's Lionel Barrymore's monologue as the lawyer in, is it The Divorcee or Free Soul? It's one of the two Norma Shearer movies. Where he goes on to talk about his failings as a father. And I'm thinking, that's not irrelevant at all.
Sides are not guilty because I'm the one that brought her up so badly. Now, Fred Carroll points that out on a Free Soul, how ridiculous that is.
To buy that a little bit more than I can buy this. And I do want to bring up, before we conclude, the 47 version mentions very briefly that Santa Claus comes back down to check and see how Christmas is going, and he doesn't agree with the commercialism of it. He has a point for doing this. In the 90s version, there's never a proper explanation. He lives at this old folks' home, but he visits the reindeer in Central Park that I guess are his reindeer. There's no real world building for his history. He just pops
and
up.
No one asks.
Yes.
No one asks.
No one asks.
The 37 movie got a B rating from the Catholic Church, and that's because Maureen O'Hara plays the divorce character. That same year, Gentlemen's Agreement came out. And they wanted them to change the central female character. She's a divorcee in the book it's based on. And they wanted to change that. And they fought them and ended up allowing her to become a divorcee. That's probably why they got away with making Maureen O'Hara a divorcee. Because before this, you couldn't be a divorcee.
Right.
Or at least you couldn't end up happily.
And Maureen O'Hara was, if anybody's read her amazing autobiography, I mean, very staunch religious woman, very pious. She mentioned this was, I think, one of her favorite movies that she's ever made. So I find that ironic. The 47 version technically turned 60 in May, but Daryl Zanuck said that people wouldn't go see a Christmas movie unless it was in a warmer climate. So he made this a summer release instead of a Christmas release. So how do you feel both incarnations have held up?
I find the remake to be almost unwatchable. I mean, it's just really just a terrible film. And I find the 47 version to be very sweet and very nice. And a lot of fun. I just think it's incredibly well made. I don't know if this quite relates, but as I said, you know, I read screenplays for contests. Someone will often have a Christmas movie about Santa Claus. And it's got to a point where they just can't have Santa Claus. They have to justify that he lives in North Pole. They have to justify how he manages to deliver all those presents. Strange moment more on Maureen O'Hara's side that Santa, I'm not sure, is the best symbol for Christmas because it's all about giving toys and it's all about what you're going to get. And how do you explain why Santa doesn't visit every single child? Why doesn't Santa do this? Why doesn't Santa? So at the very end, it's all very happy and we find out it's Santa. But after living all the years I've lived, I think it's not really a message we want to give children. That the meaning of Christmas is asking Santa for toys. And forget about all the people who don't get them. Even though I find it quite delightful, and I think it still holds up, I can't imagine anybody not enjoying it. And I think Maureen O'Hara's character was probably had a much better approach.
60 years later, it helps if you know, and I think it only makes the film more poignant if you know what the country was going for just 2 years after the year this movie came out. It could have been a very dour, downbeat type of movie. And the fact that it is so optimistic, yes, it's embracing commercialism. And yes, I think it's been embraced more for commercialism now. If you watch a Macy's ad this holiday season, they will probably play clips from this movie. But at the same time, if you really separate that, you get this message about that you can create your own family. Like, really like that element, that from the little Dutch girl to Mr. Gailey being part of the family at the end of this movie, that even though times are tough, you can still let people in. I really like that. And Natalie Wood is, I can't stress how much I love her, because I think she's just so cute in this movie. The 94 version, it's the one I saw first as a child. If you are a 90s kid that grew up with it, please go watch the original. The 94 version has a couple individual scenes that are good, and it's, if you grew up with Mara Wilson, it's about on par with most of her movies, but it really loses something in being so 90s. Longer, it's more extreme in parts, characters are very exaggerated. And the third act really has no catharsis. Yes, Susan gets her wish. I don't know how. I don't want to know how. The actual, like, Shoppers Express plotline just ends. Doesn't go anywhere. Nobody gets in trouble right. for framing a poor guy. On a story level, it fails.
One of the things that I was saying about the ending of the remake is when they get to the house, they see it's fully furnished. And that's fine. But if you go in, there's a fire going. And there's a Christmas tree. That's a little beyond being fully furnished. With presents under the tree. Actual presents.
This kid has gotten like 18 times worth what most children got from Santa Claus this year. And let's not forget that Santa Claus is apparently God because he created a human life at the end of the 94 version. Because the implication is that she's getting that little brother in 9 months. So I guess that was Santa's doing too.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Hollywood, for making me think of that. Listeners, you can tell me your thoughts on either version of Miracle on 34th Street. You can tell me which one you liked more by emailing your thoughts to me at ticklishbiz@gmail.com, and I will read them on the next episode. I'd once again like to thank Howard Kasner for joining me today. Howard, where can fans find and get in touch with you?
Well, I'm the only Howard Kasner on Facebook and Twitter. My blog is howardkasner.wordpress.
That'll close out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can listen to Ticklish Business a multitude of ways, either directly at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com, via Stitcher Radio or Player FM, or on iTunes. If you are listening via iTunes, please consider helping out the podcast by leaving a rating and review. As always, you can contact me directly at ticklishbiz@gmail.com or visit me at my official website, where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. I am taking suggestions for 2018 episodes, so if there's a star, a movie, a theme that you want to discuss, then consider leaving me an email because it'd be great to get some of your audience input. The podcast is also on Twitter at ticklish_biz, so if you don't want to send me a formal email, feel free to send me a tweet. Want to listen to episodes early or have me review your favorite film? Then consider supporting Ticklish Business via Patreon. I have a wealth of amazing perks, and all your donations go right back into making Ticklish Business the premier classic film podcast. If you are considering becoming a patron, I am going to be putting up in the next couple of days my interview with Bombshell, the Hedy Lamarr story director, Alexandra Dean. So that's something you cannot listen to anywhere else. So if you want to listen to it, consider becoming a patron. So, of course, if you're interested in becoming a patron, just head over to patreon.com/ticklishbiz. Next time, the Christmas festival, I guess at Ticklish Business, I still need to come up with a theme name for this. I'm going to be joined by Lauren Humphreys Brooks as we talk about Barbara Stanwyck and take a visit to Christmas in Connecticut. Till next time.